The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
President Bush said publicly and privately many, many times throughout 2002, my mind isn't made up. Now, I do think that he was leaning very much towards the idea of war, was very inclined to depose Saddam by military force, and said that frequently as well. But no one really tested his insistence that his mind wasn't closed on the subject, that he was willing to hear others speak of this. And because they didn't test it, they instead built, I guess you could call, a wartime apparatus, I mean, including interagency meetings that dealt with all these supposed eventualities of war, such as a humanitarian crisis, such as Saddam perhaps setting the oil fields aflame. All were predicated on the notion that war was going to happen.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for August 18th, 2020. President Trump's relationship with the intelligence community is back in the news again, after allegations that his administration manipulated an intelligence report to show a false equivalency between Russian efforts to interfere in the 2020 presidential election on his behalf and similar efforts by China and Iran on behalf of his opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden. Yet Trump isn't the first president to try and get the intelligence community to align its assessments with his preferred version of the facts, and he's most likely not the last. This week, I sat down with journalist Robert Draper to discuss his new book on one of the most infamous cases of intelligence manipulation in recent history, entitled To Start a War: How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. We also discussed his recent article for the New York Times Magazine detailing the Trump administration's efforts to change intelligence reports on election interference, and what these cases can tell us about the relationship between the presidency and the intelligence community. It's the Lawfare Podcast for August 18th. Manipulating Intelligence Then and Now with Robert Draper. Robert, you start your book To Start a War with the September 11th attacks. And it's a recurring theme throughout the book, the relationship between these attacks and the invasion of Iraq. And of course, that's a relationship that's controversial, that's contested because of disputes about the role, if any, and by now I think most people accept there wasn't any, that Saddam Hussein and his regime played in the 9/11 attacks. But your focus is really more on the impact of the attacks on America and Americans and how that set the stage for the Iraq invasion. Describe that a little bit for us. Tell us how 9/11 kind of started the trajectory towards the Iraq invasion in your view.
Sure. Scott, I wish I had a dollar for every time I heard from someone 9/11 changed everything. It did not change everything, but it changed a great deal. It altered the mindset of Americans who I believe viewed the U.S. as invulnerable. Most importantly, it changed the collective mindset of the Bush administration, which should have but did not see 9/11 coming, the attacks on America's homeland, and responded with a conviction that they would never let such an occurrence take place again, but also that surely there would be another attempt. And so if one can say that 9/11 was a failure of the imagination or failure to understand that something like this could occur, you could argue that the run-up to Iraq involved an overextension of the imagination, of imaginations gone wild, because there were these whole scenarios conjured up, most acutely by the president, but by others as well, that there would be another 9/11, that it would probably be worse, it could involve weapons of mass destruction, that must be prevented at all costs, and to do so The administration needed to take a look at state sponsors of terror who might possess weapons of mass destruction and hand them over to Al-Qaeda. So in the collective psyche of the Bush administration, the two were inextricably joined, even though, as you correctly point out, Scott, there was no meaningful link between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, much less any link at all between Saddam and the 9/11 attacks.
So one of the great ways that you kind of capture this psychological echo of the 9/11 attacks and the way that impacts people is through pretty poignant and often in some ways surprisingly sympathetic character portraits of a lot of the key figures that are involved in the decision to go to war in Iraq and the debates around the Bush administration. For people of my generation who kind of came of age with the Iraq War as the backdrop, a lot of them have become sort of larger than life figures, often very villainized figures. But a couple of your portraits, not necessarily all of them, but a number of them do kind of bring out a more complex and, like I said, sympathetic view of some of the people involved, I think in a way that really captures a degree of their perspective. I think one of the most interesting portraits that you kind of start and end the piece with is Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, who is kind of driving a lot of the decision to go to war in Iraq and providing some of the intellectual ballast behind it. Give us a little bit of a taste of what your view of Paul Wolfowitz is. What was his mentality going in? Why was he so focused on Iraq, even from before the 9/11 attacks? And how did that perspective carry through his time in the administration and afterwards?
Sure. Wolfowitz is a very complicated human being. He happens to be a Republican, but I think that his ideology is driven as much by idealism in the manner of many liberal Democrats as it is by, say, Cold War thinking. And he's is not a comfortable fit with the term neoconservative because he was propelled much more by idealism than by the belief that projection of military force around the world was important to basically let people know who's boss. The animating moment in Wolfowitz's life was when he, during the Reagan administration, was U.S. ambassador to Indonesia and had exposure for the first time to a Muslim-majority country that nonetheless was religiously tolerant. And it awakened in Wolfowitz, who also, by the way, had been very much into the civil rights movement, had attended Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in Washington in 1963. The connective tissue for Wolfowitz was the struggle for equal rights in America was a struggle that could be transposed, could be seen across the world. And in particular, his focus on Iraq came to be as a result of then, after serving in the Reagan administration, serving in the first Bush administration as Under Secretary of Defense for Policy under Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. You'll recall that the first Gulf War took place during that period. And at the time, the decision was made by then President George H.W. Bush to rout Saddam's troops out of Kuwait, but that was a fulfillment of the international charter of the coalition, and to then try to depose Saddam in Baghdad by military force was outside of their purview. Wolfowitz went along with that, at least for a moment in time, but then he saw how Saddam proceeded to put down a Shia uprising against him with real butchery, killing tens of thousands of people. Wolfowitz saw that as a betrayal and actually apologized to a prominent Iraqi author and refugee, Kanan Makiya, about that. And I think set his mind, therefore, to the at times quixotic task throughout the 90s of convincing lawmakers that Saddam needed to be overthrown. He came in then to the second Bush administration, still with that ambition, but recognizing with some frustration, I think, that the new president, George W. Bush, for all the personal animus he had towards Saddam, who after all had tried to assassinate his father in 1993, or so the intelligence would suggest, that despite that, Bush wanted to be a domestic president. He had a domestic agenda. He wanted to pass tax cuts. He wanted to do energy and education reform. And so Wolfowitz had to sort of put his notions of overthrowing Saddam by military force to the side until September 11th, when he basically saw the opportunity and took it.
So in the early days of the Bush administration, you see senior administration officials kind of begin to divide into two camps around the question of Iraq. On the one side, you have the Cheney-Rumsfeld-driven camp, in which Paul Wolfowitz is an influential figure among others, who pretty quickly become persuaded that Iraq is an issue that needs to be dealt with. And on the other side, you have certainly Secretary of State Powell, and to some extent early on, George Tenet, CIA director, Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, although both of them oscillate a little bit or try and span the two, at least in your telling, at their various points. But we see the former camp really begin to win out in President Bush's thinking. How do they do that? What are the strategies they deploy to become the more influential camp towards the president? And what shortcomings do the other actors, Secretary Powell, Tenet, Condoleezza Rice, do they bring? What are the problems with their approach to the president that lead them to ultimately lose out to this more aggressive, forward-leaning camp?
Well, as you've correctly described it, there were two forces at play, and one of them was, put, I guess, in the most basic of terms, we need to get the people who did this to us on September 11th. We need to go after Al-Qaeda. And there is immense global sympathy for us in that cause, a lot of solidarity from which we can draw. And so that should be our single-minded focus. Conversely, if we broaden our efforts to extend well beyond Al-Qaeda to attack other people who we believe might in the future be co-sponsors, let's say, of a terrorist attack against us, we will lose all international goodwill. People will say, you are working another agenda here. Now, that was the one side, and you're right that was primarily promoted by Secretary of State Colin Powell. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had a rejoinder to this notion about, well, if we go into other countries besides Afghanistan, which is harboring Al-Qaeda, then that will fray our coalition. Rumsfeld's rejoinder to that was, well, then it's not a coalition worth having. Rumsfeld's view was, let's get a coalition that's behind what we want to do. First, we establish our mission. The mission defines the coalition. The coalition should not define the mission. So basically, you know, let's attack whoever we want to attack. Are you with me or not? If you're not, okay, step aside. And that was very much the view, I think, of his old friend Dick Cheney, who had believed that throughout the years, whenever America had suffered any kind of attack, be it, say, the embassy bombings in Africa or the USS Cole off the coast of Yemen, America had maybe tossed a few bombs or something as a retaliatory gesture, but basically weren't serious about a response. And Cheney's view was that meant that America was kind of a paper tiger. And unless and until we truly project force, truly let the world know that we will not brook such attacks and that we will anticipate such attacks with overwhelming force, then these attacks will continue. And so you're right that basically, there was on one side the State Department, led by Colin Powell, to a large degree the CIA, and to a lesser degree the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and on the other side the Office of the Vice President and the Pentagon, with Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, trying to be the interlocutor between the two. I think, you know, trying to convey a sympathy of caution, of not getting beyond, getting over their skis. But on the other hand, keeping very attuned to whatever the president's wishes were, because Rice's view was really that her job, in addition to mediating disputes, was to facilitate whatever the president wanted to do. And so I think we see from the period of, let's say, October 2001, all the way through the summer of 2002, Rice more or less occupying this middle space. But by the latter part of 2002, she too began to join the cause of the individuals who believed that war was necessary.
So in the camp of senior administration officials that are looking towards potential invasion of Iraq at this point, you have a number of different motivations. And that's not necessarily surprising, of course. Any sort of policy decision has different motivations by the different people supporting it. It's rarely monocausal. In this case, we see a Wolfowitz camp, which is driven a little bit by ideology, by humanitarian concerns, by a desire perhaps to see democracy take off somewhere in the Middle East or in Iraq, certainly out of a degree of opposition to the admittedly brutal Hussein regime and some of the things it had done to the Iraqi people in the prior subsequent decades. And then you see also another camp. This is kind of the Cheney camp, as you've described it, that primarily sees a need for the United States to act in a sort of muscular fashion, to express its willingness to address threats so as to serve a deterrent to future such threats. And the question that leads me to ask you is, to what extent did either of them really rely on their motivation in this conflict on the belief that Iraq itself posed a unique threat or an exceptional threat, as we saw the line sort of became in terms of the argument to go to war? Is it that that was always a little bit of a pretext? Iraq was simply a convenient and available test case? Or was there a genuine belief on their parts that Iraq somehow stood above the other dictatorships and the other threats to the United States and warranted special focus, particularly such a unique special focus as to be the next target after the war in Afghanistan of U.S. military intervention?
Sure. I think you've accurately described, say, the Cheney camp and the Wolfowitz camp. We'll do it that way. So with the Wolfowitz camp, to anybody who would engage in dialogue with the Deputy Secretary of Defense, he would lead with, look, Saddam is an evil dictator who has brutalized his people. And from my perspective, that is the reason to depose him. It always was before and after 9/11. That has never changed. However, in the furtherance of that goal, I am more than happy to support another argument that might have wide appeal, the argument that everyone can agree on, and that ultimately became the argument that Saddam possessed weapons of mass destruction. Cheney, I think, very much subscribed to the view that Saddam possessed WMD. But you're right that his original view was, I think, guided more than anything else as the former Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration, that this was unfinished business in a way, that Saddam had only, in his view, grown as a threat and as an arrogant and brutal dictator, and was sort of looming out there as someone who was a threat that needed to be dealt with one way or the other. Cheney was sincerely convinced that Saddam had chemical and biological weapons, was actively pursuing nuclear weapons. However, I do believe that he crossed a line when, in August of 2002, he stated declaratively in an infamous speech in Nashville, simply stated, there can be no doubt Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Well, there was a great deal of doubt, and there was no one from the CIA who would say that with such lack of equivocation. And so... In sum, you're correct to recognize that there is a distinction to be made between what these individuals sincerely and individually thought and what they ultimately signed on to as an argument for war. That's not to say that Wolfowitz believed that Saddam didn't have weapons. He actually believed that Saddam was really capable of anything, but he wasn't so much wedded to any particular intelligence saying that. That was just simply a belief born out of his brutal behavior towards the Iraqis.
So the biggest obstacle for this kind of pro-war camp at this point for building this narrative, this more consensus narrative of Iraq as a serious threat to the United States that warrants this sort of action, is at this point the intelligence community. There simply doesn't seem to be the sort of evidence, the sort of smoking gun or anything really, really approaching it to support this idea that the Hussein regime was accumulating chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons or trying to do so and deploy them in a way that really threatened the United States or broader regional stability at this point. But then we see this camp, the Cheney-Rumsfeld pro-war camp, kind of systematically break down and push back against the intelligence community to shape its conclusions, to the point where ultimately, of course, we famously have CIA Director George Tenet sitting behind Secretary of State Powell as he makes his presentation to the United Nations about the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What are the strategies that we saw this camp deploy to systematically get the intelligence community to change the assessments and ultimately come on board with their agenda?
Well, it starts with 9/11, literally that evening, when Paul Wolfowitz tasks the Defense Intelligence Agency not to find whatever information they can about the 9/11 hijackers. The airplane manifest was already in his hands. Instead, what he was asking for were the history of links between Iraq and terror groups. So already he was pushing for this notion that Iraq should be viewed not just as the country ruled by an awful dictator, but a country ruled by a man who sponsored terrorist attacks, much like the one that had just occurred. And so he and Scooter Libby, the chief of staff of Vice President Cheney and others, began pushing this notion that Saddam must have had something to do with 9/11. And then when that failed, just to push that in general, Saddam would have something to do with a future 9/11, that he would confederate with Al-Qaeda, despite overwhelming evidence that Osama bin Laden saw Saddam as the very antithesis of the caliphate that he embraced as an ideal. And so there was all this conflict and this continual hammering on the agency, which held firm, basically, on pushing back against the notion that there were meaningful operational links between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. So then by the time that the argument began to shift to weapons of mass destruction, in a way, it was as if there was a collective sigh of relief that finally we can sort of agree on something here. We can't say with certainty, we in the intelligence community, that Saddam possesses a big stockpile, but we think he does. And we do think that he has a kind of active program. We do believe that he has, he certainly used them before. He used them against his own people and against the Iranians. And they have behaved deceptively, the Iraqi regime, ever since the end of the first Gulf War. So, yeah, we feel much more comfortable with that assessment than any kind of link with Al-Qaeda. And so I think that now the administration proceeded to do was to use those analytical assessments by the CIA and state them as facts. And in so doing, the CIA became the chief case maker for war. There is an infamous moment in the Iraq saga that was first memorialized by Bob Woodward in his book Plan of Attack, where, and this is the way most people, I think, interpreted this moment at the time, Bush is having a meeting, a briefing with the CIA on Saddam's weapons program. And Bush says, wait a minute, I'm not impressed by this. And he seems to be suggesting, wow, maybe Saddam doesn't have weapons. Are you sure he does? To which George Tenet, the director of the CIA, responds, oh, it's a slam dunk. That is not what occurred. In fact, as my research found, and including notes taken of the meeting, during that meeting, what the president was saying was, look, I'm convinced Saddam is a threat. I'm convinced he has weapons. You guys, however, have mounted a pretty lackluster case here. You guys in the CIA, can you do better? We'll bring in people from Madison Avenue. We'll bring in lawyers to help amass the argument. But can you supply better intel? Because we need it. And it's to that that Tenet replied, oh, yes, sir, slam dunk. We can do better. So what that moment illustrates is that, in my view, the intelligence community had crossed a bright red line and had become part of a marketing campaign of selling the war to the American public and beyond, which is not a place that the intelligence community ever wants to find itself in.
You describe some of the interactions that some of these officials had with intelligence community professionals, working level career people. You describe Wolfowitz and others doing this repetitive questioning, sending the same question down for analysis over and over again with slightly different wordings. You describe nitpicking and efforts to kind of pick apart phrasing and presentations repeatedly by different officials. There are also descriptions that you have in there about parallel tracks where you would see the Defense Department open offices intended to duplicate a lot of times the efforts of a State Department effort or a CIA effort, but presumably in a way that is more catered to the Secretary of Defense's preferences. What do these different tactics do to the career intelligence staffers working on these issues? What sorts of incentives do they present to them in terms of how they come about their opinions?
I didn't find any evidence, Scott, that that the analysts in the intelligence community, as a result of this incessant hammering by Scooter Libby, Paul Wolfowitz, and others, began to just be worn down and change their assessments. I saw no evidence of that at all. Instead, what happened was that their conclusions just simply came to be ignored. It's very difficult for me to tell, by the way, just what the motivation was for guys like Wolfowitz and Libby to be asking essentially the same question over and over, somewhat differently, and then to pounce on any answer that appeared to be different from the one they'd gotten a few days earlier, saying, okay, what's happened here? You said X, 3 days ago, now you're saying Y. It's hard to tell whether this was just an intellectual exercise or an opportunity to basically show that, look, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You're floundering all over the place. But in any event, it did not reach any meaningful conclusions. And I think that the CIA could ultimately walk away from the whole experience on the Al-Qaeda Saddam connection saying, we won. But I actually don't think they did win. And the reason I don't think they did was because you listen to George W. Bush, the decider himself, saying over and over, all the way up until wartime, that Saddam would like nothing more than to hand over his weapons of mass destruction to terrorists who, like Saddam, hate our freedoms and want to do to us again what they did in 9/11, and then for Saddam to walk away without leaving a fingerprint. Everything that I just described to you there, which essentially is what the president would say over and over, had zero basis in fact. There was no intelligence conclusion that assessed that Saddam had meaningful ties to Al-Qaeda, that he would hand over his weapons to them, that he himself wanted the U.S. homeland attack. There was no evidence to support any of that. And yet it clearly had taken hold in the president's mind, and that's because it had been repeated so frequently by Vice President Cheney and others. And essentially confirmed the biases of President Bush, that Saddam was an evil man, and that evildoers would confederate against the freedom-loving Americans, that ultimately the intelligence didn't matter. So I suppose you could say the CIA won the battle but lost the war there.
In your history, as you get closer to the actual invasion of Iraq in 2003, you describe a breakdown in sort of the decision-making process at the National Security Council or within the higher echelons of the U.S. government, both in the lead-up to the war and afterwards in regards to some of the CPA orders. The spot where it really stuck out to me is regarding CPA orders 1 and 2, which of course debathified or kind of outlawed people who had been members of the Ba'ath Party from having a variety of roles in government, and then also disbanded the Iraqi military, two steps that the people on the ground at that phase in Iraq had opposed, that had been routed through sort of a regular process through the White House, hadn't been fully vetted, but nonetheless were implemented rapidly by Paul Bremer, the CPA coordinator at that point. And you are, in describing this breakdown of process, I'm curious as to what the relationship between that is and this engagement with the intelligence community. Is what we're seeing with the intelligence community, this effort to shift conclusions and reach certain outcomes and work around some of the more conventional channels by which prior presidents have usually relied on the intelligence community, feed into the development of an alternative decision-making process, something a little more informal that involves a smaller group of people who are more ideologically aligned? And does that lead to drive not just the formulation of the justification for the invasion, but actually a lot of the policy around Iraq during these early years, right before and right after the invasion?
Yeah, what happened was that, and it's one of the more infuriating ironies of the whole Iraq saga, is that President Bush said publicly and privately many, many times throughout 2002, my mind isn't made up. Now, I do think that he was leaning very much towards the idea of war, was very inclined to depose Saddam by military force, and said that frequently as well. But no one really tested his insistence that his mind wasn't closed on the subject, that he was willing to hear others speak of this. And because they didn't test it, they instead built what I guess you could call a wartime apparatus, I mean, including interagency meetings that dealt with all these supposed eventualities of war, such as a humanitarian crisis, such as Saddam perhaps setting the oil fields aflame, and various other things that, in fact, did not come to pass. But in any event, all were predicated on the notion that war was going to happen. And so Bush's decision space was filled only with allusions to war and not to avoiding war. But there was another component to this too. And I think that this was very much not fact-based. And the agency, among others, pushed back against this notion, which was that as dire as the case for war was, meaning as much of a threat as Saddam seemed to be, there was a kind of almost airy and sunny view of what would happen after the invasion. That is to say, that Iraqis would quickly and joyously coalesce around the prospect of a post-Saddam democracy. People in the CIA warned against this as well, and warned in particular that, as you have cited, the Coalition Provision Authorities orders number 1 and 2 by Jerry Bremer, first to disband the army and then to debathify the government, threw tons of people off of the work rolls. To be a member of, to be an educator, to be an engineer, you had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party. And so suddenly they had no teachers, they had no engineers. And then for that matter, the people in the army were now unemployed. Tens of thousands of men armed and unemployed and angry. Charlie Seidel, the CIA's first chief of station in Baghdad, had warned Bremer about this, had said this was folly, had said that in fact, you know, we can reconstitute the Iraqi army, and that's the way to go. Otherwise, you are essentially laying the groundwork for an insurgency. And unfortunately, the late Charlie Seidel was prescient on that score.
Your book, of course, focuses on the lead up to the Iraq War and some of the early phases, but it does spend some time looking at how the remainder of the conflict plays out for the remainder of the Bush administration. And it does describe the shift around 2006 to 2007, when you see a lot of these big personalities driving the initial operations leave, including Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, including Wolfowitz, including Doug Feith, are no longer in government. And you see a shift both in regards to the awareness of the dangers, of course, that come with the Iraq invasion, because now they are experiencing in the form of a serious uprising, serious domestic violence there that's costing American lives, and a kind of re-engagement with some of the other institutions of government that often drive policymaking in this space. In particular, you describe a pretty telling engagement between Ambassador Ryan Crocker in Iraq and President Bush around the problems facing the new transitional government there in Iraq. The question I have is, what was the big shift between those two phases? What changed in the decision-making process and structure? Is it just the departure of the personalities, or was there something more institutional that came about because of the emergence of the failures of the Iraq War, the failure to find WMD, and the sudden experience of being stuck in a conflict that was imposing real costs?
What it was more than anything else was that President Bush became aware that defeat was imminent, and began paying attention in a way that he had not before. We were talking earlier about Bremer's coalition orders to disband the army and debathify the government. That was in contravention of what had been agreed upon in the National Security Council, the contravention to what the president himself had subscribed to. But basically, when Bush was told in an NSC meeting, Bremer has just reversed policy, Bush kind of waved it off and said, you know, I trust my guy on the ground. And he was utterly detached from the very, very meaningful details. So you're right. By 2006, Bush still believed that there were weapons out there somewhere, that maybe they'd been moved to the Syria desert or something. But what he most of all believed was that things were spinning out of control in Iraq, that their rosy notions of a quick democratic solution, of there being no sectarian tensions, had all fallen asunder. And he realized now that Iraq could very well become an irretrievable state of chaos. This is a phenomenon of George W. Bush, a paradox of his character, a guy who could be very intellectually rigorous when he felt like it, but who also could just sort of check out, leave the details to others, feel like that was beneath him, and frankly be intellectually lazy until he could smell the whiff of defeat. This was the case in 2000 when John McCain clocked him in the New Hampshire primary, and he suddenly realized, wow, I thought this was going to be a cakewalk, but I'm on the verge of losing. my ability to be president of the United States. It would also prove to be the case in Hurricane Katrina, where Bush became very, very disengaged from the details, left it all to FEMA and to others, and then realized things were spinning out of control. And it was the case with Iraq. He could see fellow Republicans heading for the exits and saying, we want nothing more to do with this. And so the president put everything behind a surge. And I remember interviewing him at the time, suddenly became incredibly conversant with Iraqi politics, with who was in charge of what all the daily metrics were, in a way that he had never been beforehand. Suddenly he realized, as is so often the case with George W. Bush, that the details really do matter. And I think that more than anything else describes all of these changes, including changes in personnel that were occurring during that window of 2006 and 2007.
So in addition to your book, you recently wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine about the potential manipulation of intelligence in a very different context, and that is today's context, specifically in regards to how the Trump administration has approached and at times pressured the intelligence community to adjust its evaluations of the role that Russia is seeking to play has played, in the 2016 election and is potentially seeking to play in the 2020 and 2024 elections through election interference and manipulation, specifically in a way that supports President Trump or at least opposes his opponents and tries to cast them as a sort of establishment that's inherently anti-Russia, among other things. It's a fascinating article, particularly to read in dialogue with your recent book. I'd be curious to hear, what are some of the parallels you see and some of the differences you see between these two cases of what, for lack of a better way to describe it, is the intelligence manipulation, efforts to shape the way that the intelligence community reaches and communicates certain conclusions? Is what the Trump administration is pursuing a very different breed than what happened in the lead up to the Iraq war? Or are there disturbing parallels, not just around election interference, but potentially around coronavirus in China or tensions with Iran and the variety of other issues where we've seen the Trump administration come to heads with its own intelligence community?
Now, the parallels are very notable, but so are the distinctions. It's worth remembering that Trump rose to power, distinguishing himself from his Republican opponents in the primary by saying, all you guys with all your experience and all your supposed expertise, and yet you all supported this ridiculous, endless Iraq war and this stupid notion that Iraq had WMD. Trump really did believe that, who knows whether Trump really supported or didn't support the Iraq war, that the evidence is a little bit sketchy. But he certainly did convince himself over time that it was a huge intelligence disaster. What's happened, though, under the Trump administration is has one thing in common from the Iraq saga, and that is the truth ultimately really didn't matter. I mean, it's as I was alluding to before, Scott, George W. Bush believed he understood the truth in his gut, which was that Saddam is an evil man and wanted to do us harm. And meanwhile, that Iraqis so wanted to be done with Saddam that they would welcome us with candy and flowers and would quickly embrace a new democracy. And so that was not a fact-based inquiry. And we see very much of that today. But here is the stark difference. At no time did President Bush ever say, hey, I don't like the intelligence you're bringing me, George Tenet. I don't like it. It's inconvenient to me. Go find some better intelligence. I think he ignored some of the intelligence. He didn't pay the close attention he should have, but he certainly didn't say, bring me alternative intelligence. And the other thing that Bush never did was say, you're fired, to any intelligence official who brought him intelligence that is politically inconvenient for him. Both of those things have happened in the Trump administration. He has willfully ignored and pushed back against intelligence that refutes his boasts regarding his foreign policy accomplishments, for example, defeating ISIS, or that Russia had nothing whatsoever to do with the election, or that Kim Jong-un and he are achieving a historic breakthrough in their nuclear talks. In saying otherwise, the intelligence community posed a threat to him, and he would say that they have run amok. At no time did George W. Bush ever impugn the integrity of the intelligence community, and that is now a daily occurrence in the Trump administration.
So in your piece, you have this amazing quote that you got from Ambassador Richard Grenell, who, of course, stepped in to become President Trump's kind of hand-picked acting director of national intelligence while the new director of national intelligence, John Ratcliffe, was awaiting confirmation, where in response to some questions, he replied, I'm just going to go ahead and quote it and read it out here, with a statement blasting the typical Washington types that hate the fact that Donald Trump is a Washington outsider, unwilling to play the Washington game, and won't just let the system do its thing and give us another Iraq WMD-style assessment. What does this quote by Grenell, somebody who you point out was the spokesperson or a spokesperson for the State Department during George W. Bush's administration, what does it tell you about the role that the Iraq WMD affair is playing in the popular memory and the ways that different camps may try and use it to their own advantage in political and policy discussions moving forward?
Well, one thing the Trump administration has done at any turn where the intelligence community is offering an assessment that is at odds with Trump's political agenda, they have without fail pointed to the WMD assessments that proved to be grievously flawed and said, in essence, why should we trust these people? Of course, this presupposes one thing and begs another question. What it presupposes is that the intelligence community has learned nothing from that period. And I would suggest that that is not the case. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the Iraq debacle that have not been internalized by various institutions, but the intelligence community is not one of those. I think that it has really worked to improve its analytic tradecraft and to avoid the kind of gross mistakes that it made in Iraq. But the other question that's begged is, okay, President Trump and Trump administration, if that's what you believe, the intelligence community is so worthless, so inept, or even so corrupt, then where do you get your intelligence from, if not from the U.S. intelligence community? Do you get it from Fox News? Do you get it from Breitbart? Do you get it from Alex Jones? Or do you get it from a foreign country's intelligence assessments? The notion that you therefore should not engage at all with the intelligence community is a really bizarre and I think sobering notion, attested to now by the fact that the president apparently gets about one PDB, one president's daily brief per week, where under the Bush administration and the Obama administration, it was unfailingly 6 days a week.
So through the course of your book and this most recent article, and really through the course of your career as a journalist, you have had a front row seat and talked to a lot of people who are inside the room for these cases of manipulating intelligence, of policy officials engaging with the intelligence community in ways to try and get them to reach a desired outcome that may or may not align with their actual evaluation of the facts. This is understandably a point of concern for a lot of people in our current moment. It should be moving forward. And my question for you is, based off your experiences, what are the sorts of safeguards we should be looking for to prevent this sort of behavior? What could Congress or a future administration or the kind of general public do to try and prevent these sorts of manipulations from succeeding in the future?
Well, so let's be clear. I mean, the intelligence community serves to provide truths, which are often uncomfortable truths. And administrations have historically chafed against those. I mean, every administration, including Trump's predecessor, the Obama administration, did not always like and did not always agree with what intelligence analysts brought them. But this is a sui generis case of a president who has really sought to bend one government agency after the next to his will. But it's particularly poignant when the entity you're trying to bend to your will is one that serves only to provide the truth. And so if you've got a president who's saying, I don't like the truth, here is my version of the truth, and if you step across the line and in any way defy me, I'm going to fire you. There's little you can safeguard against that with one possible exception, and that exception would be the oversight committees in the Senate and the House. And yet we have seen in the House Intelligence Committee an incredibly politicized organ that has all but abdicated its oversight obligations. And I'm referring to the Republican Party that, and as I mentioned this in the story, that when there was a kind of routine security briefing, election security briefing in February of this year, classified briefing before the House committee, and they had done one just the week previous in the Senate committee without incident. The intelligence official who was brought to testify, a woman named Shelby Pearson, simply stated that Russia favors the current president in the upcoming election. It is the intelligence community's assessment. But the Republicans on the committee went crazy over this and tried their best to pick that apart without having any factual basis themselves to offer a countervailing point of view, and then informed the president of what she had said. And as a direct result of that, her boss, acting director of national intelligence, Joe McGuire, was fired. When you have a Republicans who are basically, or any party, who are reporting from a top secret briefing directly to the White House, here's what just happened. It's just an unfathomable thing that is yet another, exhibit 912 of this is not normal, but what has become commonplace in the Trump administration. So it is very difficult, short of what will take place at the ballot box this November, to imagine some kind of safeguard against what's currently occurring.
Well, we will have to leave this conversation there for today. But Robert Draper, author of the new book, To Start a War, and of the article Unwanted Truths in the recent New York Times Magazine, thank you so much for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast.
It's really a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me, Scott.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. This podcast was engineered by Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Patcha Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.